The main event here is DNA. DNA is one of the most boring macromolecules in the world, but one of the most important. What I've got is a picture of the double helix of DNA, and it's got a backbone, which on the picture there is a whole lot of yellow and red spheres, and connected together by rungs. It's sort of a twisted ladder. It's called the double helix. It's, if we're going to be technical, it's a double alpha helix. Because it's the which way it's turning, truthfully. A lot of stuff about protein folding got talked about alpha helix and things like alpha helix B-depleted sheet. The naming's not really important, except that it's that twisted double ladder thing. Okay, so we're going to look at the nucleic acids. These are the things that store and transmit information in cells. DNA for information storage, RNA for information transmission. So they're subtly different, and we need to know some bits and pieces about them. So DNA, the D's for deoxyribose, the R's for ribose, and very briefly, last week we talked a little bit about what the difference was. The difference between the D and the R is one oxygen atom. So we also need to talk a little bit about the fact that these are, if they're information transmitting molecules, what's the information? And we can be specific about some other words as well. On my other PowerPoint, there's like a zillion words that we need to know. At the moment, we need to be sure about words like DNA, RNA, gene. Now, in this case, gene, a length of DNA that codes for a particular protein. We're going to make that, add a little bit more detail to that. We're going to make that a little bit more subtle. There are some more shades to it, but that's the basic thing. So, the structure's important, and we need to think about the fact that while it does all of these amazing things, DNA is a chemical. And as a chemical, you can deal with it in the lab. It's actually a really, really robust chemical. One of the first sorts of investigations that people did with it was a melting point test. Put DNA in a viscometer, warm it up, and at a particular temperature, the two strands separate and it suddenly goes runny. So we need to put that in context. Solutions of really long molecules are often really, really viscous, sticky and thick. Actually got it right that time. So they're sticky and thick. Stuff like golden syrup, you heat it up and it suddenly goes runny. DNA, we start with the two strands, and I talked about how long they are. They're really, really, really long. Like if you unravel all the 46 chromosomes in your body and connected the DNA together in one cell, like a millimetre across, there's enough DNA to go from the floor to the top of the door. So you've got a hell of a lot of it. The double-strandedness means that it's all twisted together, and we'll look at... Actually, you should know a few more of the features of what the double-strandedness means. But you heat it up to a certain point, the strands are held together by hydrogen bonds, and at a particular temperature, somewhere between 70 and 85 degrees, it lets go. And all of a sudden, the long strings go ping into little, sort of little balls, and the stuff suddenly goes runny. That's only half the cool stuff. If you then take that solution and cool it down again, the strands all join back up. And they join back up with almost perfect fidelity because the base pairing is the lowest energy state that they can end up in. So you can melt it, cool it, melt it, cool it, melt it, cool it, shake it around, and generally it'll be okay. If you shake it a lot, you'll break a couple of the strands. But it's tough compared to other biological stuff. If you work with enzymes, we've got to keep the temperature right, we've got to keep the pH right. DNA is more robust. Okay. Now, we need to talk about units of structure. The units of structure of DNA is the nucleotide. Well, units of structure of DNA and RNA. So, they're polynucleotide strands, if you like. DNA, strand of two sets of nucleotides stuck together. RNA, single. So, what's a nucleotide? Who remembers what a nucleotide is? Stephen? That's something else. That is a remembery thing. We've managed to remember something from it. Jason? Okay, so it's a sugar, a nitrogeny base, and one more thing. Phosphate. Okay, that's how they actually found DNA. You know, I don't know if you've come across that one about saying what elements is the human body made of, or how much are you worth if we bought you just as elements. But phosphate in the body is mostly found in the nucleic acids. So when they isolated them, they actually isolated the nucleic acids without knowing what they did. That's why we've got all the stuff like words like chromosomes and all the descriptions of the phases of mitosis, because they were observable and they were identified before people had any understanding of what they did. So, nucleotide, a phosphate, a nitrogenous base, and a sugar. Rory. One thing made of three bits, yeah, one stuck together thing, and they actually exist like that in your body. So the nucleotides exist as that group of things, all stuck together. So if you see a pentagon, it's not something you should draw a star inside and do something. In this case, it's the abbreviation for the sugar. Ribose are the oxyribose. So pentose sugar with five carbons, that's why we draw it as a pentagon. Okay. A little dot. That's the phosphate. So the backbone it's called a sugar phosphate backbone. The backbone up the side of the DNA goes sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate. And the phosphate's important because the type of bond, if we talk chemistry on this, they're single bond and they allow rotation about the bond, and so you get the geometry of the rest of the nucleotide so that the strands can stick together is where the phosphate comes in. Okay? And a base. Now, we use the word nitrogenous base. The yellow dots are phosphate. That's yep. Yep. And so the base is the ladder. The base, now, the reason we use the word nitrogenous base here is to distinguish it from stuff like sodium hydroxide and the sort of bases that you come across in year 11 science. So chemists would refer to it as a heterocyclic base. So a heterocyclic base means that they are circles of carbon atoms with some nitrogen stuck in. One of the sidebars of that is that that's what makes poo smell. Is that the compound called skatol, which is made from the degradation of some of those heterocyclic bases. If we talk about the things that stink in the world, proteins smell because they've got nitrogen and sulfur in them, so when you burn proteins, they smell bad. When you break down DNA, there's a heterocyclic base in there. It gets broken down to something called skatol, and that's the smell of human scat. Sorry?
Is some of the skatol out?
Yes. Some of it is from our diet. Yeah, we break down because we're recycling ourselves. It's like you keep on pooing even if you're on hunger strike, because things like your intestinal cells are all breaking off all the time, because that's how you deal with abrasion in your gut. And recycling. And, yeah, the brown colour is another part of it.
No.
Oh,
nah.
Okay, so phosphate links them together. Phosphate's part of the geometry. That's what's important.
So we can get a copy of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, sure.
Wait, just give me like
we'll all wait, and there'll be a long silent patch on the transcript.
There's
two naming systems for this, right? Mono, one. Di, two. Tri, three. Lots is poly or oligo. oligoelic sugars or proteins. Oligo, like poly means heaps. Oligo is quite a few.
So phosphate groups link the sugar onto
another sugar. They link it to another sugar.
Onto the, what is it, onto the phosphate?
Yep. They link the sugar on one nucleotide to the phosphate of the next. Yeah, we'll draw some more. Okay, nitrogenous base. Let's just make a list. You should know these. You should know these from year 11. ATCG.
Do we need to know these?
And draw the chemical formulas? No. No. If you're not sure, use the ATCGs. Serious students should probably be able to. Why are we not mentioning uracil? It's an RNA base. And there's another of those. This is the why are DNA and RNA different sort of questions. And the why are DNA and RNA different questions are really important. But they come back to a single unifying principle. What's the single unifying principle in biology? It's all about shape. So enzymes fit things with particular shapes. DNA and RNA have got slightly different shapes on the sugar. Uracil, as a base, slightly different shape from thymine. It's one methyl group different, but methyl group is a, like any atoms produce a shape thing. Okay? There's uracil for the...
So what does uracil say?
Uracil replaces the... Yeah.
And
if we're playing spot the difference.
A and T together, C and G.
Yeah, so A bonds with U in RNA. Yeah, yep, they are. So if we're talking about the shape of them, thymine and cytosine are both called pyrimidines, and adenine and guanine are both called purines. Effectively, from the bases, there's a base made with two rings and a base made with one ring. On the base pairing thing, the one ring base connects with the two ring base. So the distance between the two strands is always the same. So, yes, we can take this further into purines and pyrimidines, which is the chemical classification of them, but not important enough to spend time on. What we're looking for here is how DNA works and why it works. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that you can that we can look at in detail, but I want to do big picture. Okay. Here we go. If you want to remember purines and pyrimidines, pyrimidines are the bases with Ys in the name. Thymine and cytosine are pyrimidines. Pure adenine and guanine are not. So the base pairing thing, a purine bonds with a pyrimidine. Don't write it down. Well, beg your pardon. You can write it down if you like. You can write it down to something you can go away and look up. But it's a chemistry thing, and you've got to be interested in the chemistry stuff for it to be important. A bonds with T, C bonds with G. Okay, well, don't write it down. Easy. Okay. Don't write any of this. This is just a picture of the nucleotide. So adenine, two rings. Deoxyribose, those of you who can write chemical formulae, or they've got very nice books with the pictures in. And this is ATP. This is all part of how they stick together. ATP turns... Phosphates get involved in chemical reactions. Okay, we're just looking around for people who don't believe me about you don't need to write this down. And there's guanine. Look, it's still got two rings. Cytosine, one ring. That's the one ring. What shape's that? Yeah, it is. They're calling it a ring because it's a cyclic, called a cyclic compound. Because it's a cycle. Okay.
Are these pictures...
It's a textbook picture. That picture's scanned from a textbook.
Yeah, but it's not actually because it's turning phosphates gray.
Yeah. When they stick together to make the base, like when they're actually building backbone, there is a reaction that involves the triphosphates spitting off two phosphates, which is, produces the energy to link the chains together. If you're making DNA, if you're putting it in a DNA making machine, you put in the triphosphates. You just pour it in with a jug and you press the sequence you want and it spits it out.
Isn't guanine an energy drink?
No. Taurine's a good energy drink.
No, not taurine.
Okay. Guarana.
Yeah, it is.
Guana,
that's what it is.
Not sure. Okay. Righto, now if we're doing real quick drawings, this is the backbone thing. This is the circle pentagon flag drawing. Pentagon, deoxyribose, circle, phosphate, and the wee flags off the side of the bases. Okay. So the phosphate's joined to the sugar. Now, we are going to talk chemistry very briefly here, and we're going to talk it... Yeah, that's it. Okay. Chemistry, the chemistry of the sugars is... And so the little pentagon, every time there's a cut, every time there's a bend in a polygon on a picture of a chemical bond, of a chemical thing, it's assuming that there's a carbon at the angle. And the carbon's got the right number of bonds, and every bond that's not shown to another carbon is a hydrogen, unless we show something else. So, that's an... That's an O. Now, that's I just said every angle is a carbon. People who've done chemistry with me know that there's another word that goes with it. Everything's like this, and there's always except. So, this is an except. Sugars are a carbon with a hydrogen and an OH group attached to them, and I'm not deliberately not calling it a hydroxide. So, 1, 2, 3, 4... Now, we talked about how you number the carbons. So, we've got a picture of nearly deoxyribose. Deoxyribose. Question about deoxyribose is the numbering systems in chemistry have a very particular, well, they've got rules and they've got a very particular point in mind. That point is you give whatever's interesting the smallest number you can find. So, what's different about this sugar? Deoxyribose. It's got... Nope. It's missing an oxygen. It's deoxy. Where is the deoxy? Deoxy is there. Every other carbon's got an oxygen attached to it. Except this one here. So, that's the interesting thing. So we number the chain from like a beginning point, and so we number it so that one is the one just to its right. This is two. So they're numbered there. The reason it's numbered from the far, that's right, the far right-hand side is that sugars interconvert between two forms, a circle and an open chain. And the bond between that bond there, the one, the carbon that's got two oxygens attached, is the one that breaks. Because oxygens have got a much stronger attraction for electrons than anything else. And so this bond here adds a hydrogen and not. And they flick between it. In DNA, it's always cyclic. So it's numbered to give it the smallest number. That's called 2-deoxy. 2-deoxyribose. Now, those aren't the interesting numbers. The interesting numbers in 2-deoxyribose nucleic acid are carbon 3 and 5. So, Miss Parker, I lost you. Okay, so carbon 3 and 5, so you just need to be thinking about the pentagon. This is an important thing. So, if you've, those of you who've got little pieces of paper can draw a little pentagon on your paper.
You don't start one on the deoxy
because it's the whole chain.
But
and a whole, basically you number a continuous chain of carbons. So if we numbered it there, we'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, oop, back. Yep.
I don't mean to sound like an asshole, but...
do what comes naturally.
When can you put these up? Can you just give us like 2 minutes to write it down?
Or print it out.
And then...
printing it out.
Well, because if we write it down... It's like,
yeah, I understand that, yeah.
It's just because like, if you're talking, I'm writing down...
Hmm.
Like,
yep, no, no.
I don't fall, I just get confused.
Okay. Yep. So we'll go back to that one. What I wanted to say was I want to do this piece. Yeah, before then. So, bottom of the pentagon. So if we're drawing a pentagon, which we are, now you should practice drawing pentagons. Drawing pentagons is good for you. Drawing pentagons is good because one of the things if you're writing exam answers and the like is being able to draw pictures fills them in and it makes you feel better about the wide open empty spaces that you now get in exam papers. Drawing a picture and then writing stuff down the side and drawing arrows to it and things is all good. So, important from this is carbon 3 and carbon 5. So carbon 3 is the bottom left-hand corner of the pentagon. Carbon 5 is the sort of left arm up in the air. So, DNA, we have a look. We've drawn, there's a structure of DNA sitting on the screen. The flats, the pentagons are bottom down, pointy bit up. So, the bottom end is called the 3 end. Like the very first base on the very bottom of any chain is going to be a pentagon sitting on its bottom. So when we're numbering DNA, when we're naming DNA, DNA pointy ends up goes from 3 to 5. That's how it's identified. So the top of it's the 5, the bottom of it's the 3. Now, for those of you who remember things about DNA, if there's a strand attached to that, what's special about it? Yeah, it's pointing down. Pentagon's pointing down. So for this to connect, this strand going up, this strand going down. Now, I might have a little look slide-wise just to see if I've actually got a picture. Whoa, there's... famous chaps. There. Okay. That's, now, there's a fiendish chemistry picture on there, and some of you are going to feel really, really freaked by this. So.
It says that nucleotides are connected with the phosphate.
Yep.
And the sugar on the next.
Yes.
But it looks like in the drawing that it's a phosphate is connected to a carbon.
On the sugar. So the technical thing about the description is that the carbon 5 of one sugar is connected to a phosphate, which is connected to carbon 3 of the sugar above.
So it's carbon 3 goes to a phosphate.
No, five goes to phosphate.
We're going down.
Okay.
So it goes, yeah. So 3 phosphate.
Yep. This is one of those things that you do need to sort of. You do need to master. Okay. Oh, look! I've drawn lots of pentagons. Goes to the bottom left-hand corner of the pentagon. The 3 is there because there's an oxygen missing off the 2. They named this one 2. And then all the numbering goes on. That was my little picture I had before of deoxyribose. We're playing spot the difference, and you won't be able to spot the difference on the slide, but that carbon there is missing an oxygen. So they number it from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
What about...
yeah. Grab some pictures from a book and have a look and just see. We go... like, draw on them, number them, yeah, and they always referring, so the 5 to 3 direction is the other thing on that slide that's bothering Kieran. The arrow bothering you. So, we're basically talking about the direction, so they're referring to the direction is from the 5 to the 3.
What?
Is that one from the 3 to the 5?
Yeah. Let's put it the other way. These two strands are different because
one's upside down and
the pentagons are pointing, pointy bits are up on the left and down on the right. Does this now? We'll see if, whoa, it's going to work. Okay, so settle. Okay, so arrows are up. Left hand strand is pointy bits up, right hand strand is pointy bits down. So that's the deal with this. The two strands are, technical term here is anti-parallel. Anti-parallel, exactly beside each other but going opposite ways. Two trains passing each other in the night. That's quite fine, Candy. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to hang on to it. Again, when we're starting to talk about how these things are put together, this is important. For right now, we're just doing the brief flicking overview. Okay, anti-parallel matters because it's got to do with how they make copies. Right, so there's a bunch of this stuff that we're taking that it takes some wrestling to get to. So if we think sugar phosphate backbone, bases in the middle. Bases are lined up with each other because the two strands are going in opposite directions. And Stephen asked a really useful question about what sticks the bases together. The answer about what sticks the bases together is, for a chemist, what sticks the strands together?
What sticks the sugar to the phosphate?
Sugar to the phosphate is a covalent bond. If we're talking, basically all of it, like chemistry's full of this. Well, biological chemistry is full of this. Everywhere where there's a bond to be made, the simplest way of doing it is you set up a system where water gets taken out by the reaction. And here we've got H's and OH's. On the phosphate, we've got the same kind of thing. The phosphate's got four oxygens and one of them's got a hydrogen on it. You've got a sugar with hydrogens and oxygens. We can set this up so there's a reaction that pulls out water. Condensation reactions are everywhere in biology. And so if there's an enzyme making it happen, the enzyme sets it up so water's pulled out.
So what was heating it up and cooling it down?
Heating up and cooling it down don't get anywhere near the covalent bonds. What heating it up and cooling it down do is break the hydrogen bonds between the bases. So each strand is really tough and covalently bonded. To break covalently bonded things, the sort of thing that we're doing in year 12 chemistry would say, covalently bonded things, if you're trying to break the bonds, you're heating it up to hundreds or thousands of degrees. If we're heating it up to 100 degrees, it's not going to touch the bond, covalent bonds. It is going to overcome hydrogen bonds, the weak electrostatic forces that are holding the thing together. So, pentagons going up on one side, pentagons going down on the other side. Reason for it mostly is so it lines the bases up so that the bases can stick together by hydrogen bonding. So, if we're recording any of it, hydrogen bonding holds the strands together. That's the biggest of the deals with this. Okay? So, sugar phosphate backbone, pentagons pointing up one side, pentagons pointing down the other side. Two strands held together by, on the diagram it's got dotted lines, and they're hydrogen bonds. And if we look at the chemistry of the nucleotides, if we go back and find some nucleotide pictures, cytosine forms three hydrogen bonds with guanine. Yeah, that's why it's three little things. Now, if you look at cytosine, it's got a nitrogen attached to the top carbon, it's got a nitrogen in the ring, and it's got an oxygen stuck off the side here. That's three things that have got unbonded pairs of electrons that can form the. So this is talking far too much chemistry. Well, have a look. Guanine. Nitrogen, nitrogen, oxygen. It's got three things again. If we look at adenine, it's only got two. Now, what that means, if we take that to its logical extent, is that if we're looking at hydrogen bonding, and this is a picture here of the two strands together, there's three sets of dotted lines, the hydrogen bonds between guanine and cytosine, and the bases, the strands being the way round they are, lined these things up so they're close enough together to be held to hydrogen bond. So, two hydrogen bonds between adenine and thymine, three between guanine and cytosine. One of the few skills that I end up with is that I can remember numbers. And my memory of this is that if you made a pure strand of what they call polyadenine, so the sugar phosphate backbone all with A's, it would stick to a strand that was all T's. Yeah. These days, because DNA is tough, you can actually get a machine that makes it. Say, I want 25 A's in my strand. Make it. Another strand of 25 T's, you put them together, they will stick. With the hydrogen bonding, because the hydrogen, any kind of bonding happens because the bonded thing's more stable than the non-bonded thing. There's less repulsions, there's less, if we think back to doing our protein structure role play, there's less things that they hate being anywhere near them. They're all with things that reduce the overall charge on the DNA strand that make everything as simple as possible. Therefore, it sticks together. If you've got A and T, it melts at about 70 degrees, the two hydrogen bonds. If you've just got a strand of C and G, it melts at 85. So ordinary DNA will melt at some temperature in between. And actually the temperature will tell you what proportion of C's and T's and A's and C's and G's and A's and T's there are in it. And they've done lots and lots of experiments that sort of go with that as well. Okay. Base pairing we've done. Why does it do it? Because there's exactly the right amount of room. It's all this kind of geometry. Yeah. So, big picture, A bonds with T, C bonds with G. The because, higher level stuff again. Stephen.
Of course it's something like A and B and the hydrogen bonds. Couldn't you change somewhere in A and an A to go
together? No. Because which one's got the right number of hydrogens and where are the lone pairs of electrons? If we can think back to your chemistry.
So it's not like you can't get another one and try to...
No. They don't. They actually repel. They repel. So if you're trying to, if you get the two strand, you know, there's like the nice zip thing. It's where the two teeth of the zip don't connect together.
It'd be like trying to put negative.
Well, shoving two magnets together, the opposite poles. So if you look, you think of DNA as being like a zip, and it's often portrayed as a zip. If you get two A's together, they'd repel, and those would be the two teeth that wouldn't stick together. And if the two teeth don't stick together, your sleeping bag doesn't stay done up. Pyrimidines are the bases that got Y's in the name. Cytosine and thymine. Remember we said there were two kinds of bases? Cytosine always base pairs with guanine. So cytosine's got a Y in it. It's a pyrimidine, a single ring. Guanine, double ring. Again, it's like purine. Purine is a double ring. It's the ones without Y's in the name. We're getting back, let's look, size again. If we look at the picture of DNA with all the stuff blown up, that is a pyrimidine, thymine, right? The pyrimidines are actually all down the left-hand strand of this picture. One ring, one ring, one ring, one ring. On the other side, two, 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 two. And if they were swapped over, it would still be the same thing. It's so that the two sides of the letter are exactly the same. Then it twists into its big... Basically, we just need the base pairing rules. So A bonds with T, C bonds with G. If you want to know there's a reason behind it, there's a reason behind it. So, yeah, again, we take this at least three levels. Base pairing's enough to help you understand how this works. Why, if you've got the curiosity to wonder, keep asking yourself why, that's also a useful thing. If we want to take that another step further and go, okay, so why does the Y work? We can look at the chemical structure and say it all fits. You only need... Right, to understand this at a functional level, to make you literate in this, you need to understand the base pairing. To be able to pass exams, if that's what your aim is, you need to be able to understand base pairing. To understand enough of it to integrate it at the highest level, it's probably important to understand a little bit of the chemistry. If you're thinking about sitting scholarship in biology, they're going to give you three questions, and there's a chance that there'll be one that talks about this, and a fair chance that there won't. So, yeah, this is arcane knowledge, but it's there because it's useful to know. I like to know all the why, and I also almost like to be able to take it from the very beginning and go, and this happens, and explain it from what I call first principles. But takeaway, you just need to know A bonds with T and C bonds with G. Okay. Are we all done?
No.
Is everybody else done? Okay, so. A bonds with T, C bonds with G. If we're making RNA, T swaps for U. Okay. Yeah, complementary base pairing. That's the base pairing rule. Okay. Now, the biggest deal about DNA is, apart from it being chemically stable, is that it reproduces with staggeringly high fidelity. Your cells, if you're lucky, don't forget who they are. You're all made with, was it 10 trillion cells maybe? And came from how many?
One.
So you've got enough copies to make 10 trillion accurate copies of the same genetic material. Every single one of your cells has got the same code in it. Yeah, different bits of it are turned on in the right places, but every single cell's got the code. So we've got to have... It's copied a heck of a lot of times in you. Now, you can see what ageing does when you look at your teachers. And some of those things break down. Stuff that makes collagen in your skin tends to break down. Stuff that makes adds colour to your hair breaks down. I've got a viral infection at the moment. It's going to take me longer to get rid of than it would have done when I was your age. And you can show your age if you get a viral infection and you're anywhere near a baby. You know how long babies have colds for? About a day. Nah, they heal really, really fast. Healing rate's one of those things that you know as well. For a really, really new baby, things like wound healing is really, really impressive because if they're growing, there's like a whole host of new cells being made every day. If you're at your adult size, the number of new cells being made is much, much smaller. But accurate copying has to happen all the time, and when it doesn't, it's the effects of ageing and cancer. So cancer, usually produced by an accumulation of mutations over your lifetime, and it's things like inaccurate copying. Your cells forget who they are, forget to only make one copy. And if we're talking about the example of, you know, if you've got nose cancer, for example, your nose decided that it wanted to it got cancerous, it would just keep on growing, and it would forget to be nose as well. So it's just massive cells. And they're a bit more cunning than that as well, but that's what cancer cells are. They forget who they are, and they forget to stop copying. And it's an accumulation of damage. So it must replicate accurately. So information and accurate copying are the two requirements for genes to exist properly. DNA fulfills these criteria. That means, so we need to understand a little bit more of it, but that is why it's a suitable thing to deal with. Okay. We're not even going to write that down. We're going to talk about what the effect of change a little bit later on. Okay. Again, this is just how fast does DNA copy itself? It's sort of, you don't need to know it exactly, you just need to know it's, you know, quick-ish, slow-ish. If we're talking about 3,000 nucleotides per minute in a human, that's quite a lot. But how many nucleotides are there in your whole, in one cell? Three billion. So that says if you were copying a single piece, it would still take you a million minutes to copy your DNA. Now that obviously doesn't happen, so there's another corollary to that too. But bacteria replicate the DNA 10 times faster than we do. Stephen? Babies. Progeny. So progeny means babies. So making copies so that your kids end up with genetic material with an accurate copy of the genes, so that the right shape, the right species, all those sorts of things, have got the right number of bits.
So yeah, I hope that E. coli replicates real fast.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why you get
real sick? Mm-hmm. E. coli can replicate itself about once every. They grow by binary fission. They can replicate about once every 20 minutes in ideal conditions. That's how. And the reason you get sick with a bacterial infection is usually that the bacteria are spitting out digestive enzymes and digesting what's around them. And then, spitting out all their excreted material. And in some cases, those toxins are really, really bad. Like there's some strains of E. coli that are very nasty. The ones you get from undercooked mints and stuff like that are very, very nasty. There are some other paralytic ones. Botulinum toxin paralyzes your nerves. It's one of the worst poisons known to man. That's why you inject it in your face. You avoid the effects of aging with Botox by paralyzing your facial muscles. Now, Botox has actually got a number of reasons. You can use it for killing people. It's quite good at that. In fact, that's what it used to be used for quite a lot. And why you should always make sure that your canned fish is, you know, smells good. However,
is that why women always like
women with Botox? Yeah, have worked out that effectively, as long as your lips move, and they're full of collagen from your bum, as long as your lips move, people can lip read and work out what you're doing, and they don't tend to. The theory went that they don't tend to look at you from your eyes up. So if you paralyse yourself from your eyes up, it's okay, because you don't look wrinkly. And I mean, you know, I'm a really bad example for wrinkly, so I'm a really good example of why you shouldn't smoke and why you shouldn't spend time outdoors and why you shouldn't smile lots. Those three things together have, you know, written stories on my face. However, there's the other one about Botox, which is also sort of useful and slightly creepy, which is that you can also use them to paralyse your sweat glands. If you think you sweat too much under your arms, you can get Botox injections under your arms and paralyse your sweat glands. Well, as long as you sweat somewhere else, it's okay. And again, you see, it's the same kind of logic that says if the top half of your face doesn't have to move so you can go and look nice in public, you can not have to do exercise outside and deal with the fact that the sweat glands under your arms have been paralysed. Or the sweat glands in the palms of your hands.
Well, they would do that for people that are sweating thing, they just
the like there's dreadful ads on TV. The squirting people. Yes. It's sort of revolting. So, Botox would fix that. Obviously, adding aluminium sulfate fixes that too. If your body has to cool down, because the biggest thing for your body is keeping your brain cool. That's the big deal, and your body will take radical action to try and deal with that. Well, radical action including shutting you down because your exercise is producing too much heat. Yeah, shut it. Yeah. You pass out. Yeah, you pass out. Just go. All that dreadful story about Hamish Carter waking up because he'd overheated and like. The marathon, he was an Ironman or a triathlon, but found, you know, lying on a gurney with like ice shoved up his bum and all those things trying to cool you down radically. Whoa. Yeah, it's probably something you want to try avoiding.
So another human being put ice cubes in
or it might have been really, really cold saline solution. Yeah, but yes.
Why wouldn't they just put it on a
tricep? Oh, it's everywhere. If you overheat, you have to take radical action really fast, because if you overheating is much, much worse than overcooling, because if your enzymes change shape permanently, you don't work anymore.
Yep.
You're sort of rubbery and it's called cooked.
Is that why you're like coming as hard out in the shower?
Potentially so. I haven't tried it, but you hope the glass is safety glass and all those sorts of but yeah, sometimes too much heat deals with it in that sort of fashion. And that's because proteins are more fragile than DNA. Okay. Accuracy of DNA replication is very, very high. Now, there's two parts to it. One error per billion bases. Now, if you're copying your DNA, that means that every time it copies, you get about 3 errors in it. And that comes to the everybody's different sort of theory. So there is some variation. One of the reasons that you always get colds and always get flu is really, really bad at copying its DNA. Really bad at it.
So if it copied it real accurately,
your immune system would remember it from last time.
Okay.
And so the point with viruses is they've got really sloppy error checking mechanisms. And they produce millions and millions of copies. So the chance has to be that only one still works as a virus, because a whole lot of them won't work. The mutations will go, try to put the protein together, go, nah, it doesn't work. But if one of them gets through, it's changed a bit, your immune system remembers shape. So if it's changed, the shape's different, it's new to your immune system. Yeah, usually they mutate and they become virulent across species because they've suddenly changed what they stick to. So usually a virus in a population becomes less dangerous as time goes by, because it's not in the virus's best interests to kill the host fast. HIV is a great, really successful virus because it's made zillions of copies and potentially infected heaps and heaps of people before it kills its host. So it's a really, really effective pathogen. And, you know, it's obviously managed to hijack human behaviour really effectively as well. And so human behaviour has meant that it's an even better pathogen because, you know, spread along things like road routes through Africa. And that's, you know, almost entirely heterosexual transmission. It evolved itself for homosexual transmission in the United States when it first appeared certainly in the West. But almost all transmission in the third world is heterosexual or mother to baby. And there are particular cultural practices that made that much more dangerous. Okay, what else? Okay, we're going to talk about replication. We'll talk about replication another time. Can I suggest? Okay, so this is probably something some of you are looking as if your brains are a little bit bent. Can I suggest, therefore, that we need to do some reading about this? So, textbook, pages 48, 49, and 50 of the DNA stuff. But I'd also like you to do the DNA replication, which is 51 and 52. So 48 through 52. I'm just about to put these recordings up. Where do you want them?